three covenants with Abraham. And again, normally when we talk about Abraham and three covenants of Abraham, what comes to our mind very quickly are the three wives. We have the Hagar representing the law covenant, Sarah representing the grace covenant, Keturah representing the new covenant. These are not the covenants that we are going to discuss today, believe it or not. We are going to talk about the times where God made covenants with Abraham, which also happens three times. It's in Genesis 12. We know Genesis 12 because he says, pack up and move. In Genesis 22, we have where he's willing to sacrifice Isaac. And Genesis 15, the one that we're going to focus on today, is he believed in the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him for righteousness. So we see in Genesis chapter 12, this is where God tells Abraham, this is the reason for the first covenant. He says to leave everything behind you've ever known. Leave behind your father's house, and I'm going to send you to a new land. And Abraham does it. And in Genesis 22, he asks Abraham to be willing to sacrifice his own son. And he is. And so that's where we have the famous covenant of in thee and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth, shall all the families of the earth be blessed, as it says in Acts 3:25. This one in the middle is a little bit less well known. And it might be my favorite. And I'll share with you why in just a little bit. There's two aspects of it we're going to talk about. But in this one, God says to Abraham that he's going to bless him. And Abraham says, I don't have any children. And God says, you're going to. And Abraham believed him, and he counted him for righteousness because of it. And we also read that in Romans chapter 4, verse 3. So let's take a look at this covenant in Genesis 15, and we're going to talk about predicting the future, and we're going to talk about our consecration, and they're both really special. So first, God tells Abraham, get me a heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and then get me a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Now, does anybody find these things a little odd? You might. You might not. When we take a look at it and we look at the instructions, what he says is to bring him animals of a certain age. And so when you ask yourself, why are the ages important? Why are the ages important? It says, again, in the prophetic language, what is a prophetic day? And the answer is a prophetic day is each day for a year. And we know that from Numbers 14:34 and Ezekiel 4:6. These are what Brother Russell used to explain to us the prophetic days. And so, of course, it's 1 year for each day. Well, let's take a look at some of the years and how they add up. So the heifer is 3 years old. The goat is 3 years old. The ram is 3 years old. Now, he doesn't mention an age for the turtle dove or the pigeon. And so what Brother Russell suggests, and I agree with, is that we'll say the year was one. And that totals up 11 years. Now, why is 11 years significant? Again, this promise was, I am going to give you the land of Israel. And he specifies the borders of the land. This is the promise. Well, how many days are there in a Jewish calendar? And it is 360 days a year. So if we multiply that times 11, giving it 1 year for each day, that comes out to 3,960 years. When was this prophecy given? It's estimated 245 BC. 2045 BC, to be exact. So when we look at 2045 BC and we say, well, what happens 3,960 years later? It brings us to 1914. Now, why is that important? Also, why is it 1914 and not 1915? I think we know this pretty well, but just, you know, as a refresher, again, when we look at 2045 to 1915, it's actually, it gets us to 1915 instead of 1914. But remember, there's no year zero. There's one BC and then there's one AD. So we have to subtract that year zero. And so that's why we say, well, it's not 1915, it's 1914. And that's pretty consistent across the prophetic spectrum. So what happens in 1914? Why is this a significant number? And why would it be worthy of bringing up? Well, in 1914, we see the end of the Gentile times, the last of the world empires. And a couple of things that happen is that the Jewish people are affected specifically. And the reason is, it says, as a perennial scapegoat, the Jews were blamed for many of the Bolshevik coup d'etats of October 1917, and approximately 100,000 Jews were killed in the anti-Bolshevik campaigns conducted by the Ukrainians, Poles, and Russians. And so what we see is this blaming some of these tragedies on the Jews and the Jews being persecuted for it. And so now they start to return to Israel. They start to go back. And as we see these things happen, we know that they started to go back in 1878, but it wasn't a mass return. Now we're seeing Jews from all over Europe return to Israel for the first time in a couple thousand years. In 1917, we have the Balfour Declaration, where the British Prime Minister says it's now legal for them to own land in Israel. And so the Jewish people were not only legally to own land, in 1948, again, just 31 years later after that, they're declared a nation. And so we look at 1914 as a significant day for that. So the promise was, in the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thee, unto thy seed I've given this land. And 3,960 years later, the years for the number of animals, it was happening again. And the difference with Israel being given this land in 1914 versus the first time as they go through the Exodus of Egypt is this time it's permanent. And so when you ask yourselves, how do you prove the Bible is real? We were having this study with some of the young people in Columbus. How do you prove the Bible is real? Where's the scientific proof? This is it. There's no way that somebody 4,000 years ago could have randomly made this up or come up with it and had it coincidentally end up in 1914. The Bible told the future 4,000 years in advance. And wouldn't you know, when he says, I'll punish you seven times, again, it's from a different date. But again, we look at the prophetic calendar starting in 605 BC, where this is a couple of things happen in 605 BC. This is where we think that Jeremiah actually pronounced to Israel, your time is up. And also, this was the time of the very first, let's just say, mini siege of the Babylonian Empire. And it also comes out to 1915, subtracting the year zero, 1914. So 1914 is a date that signified their punishment will end. 1914 is a date that God said to Abraham, I will give your children this land. And again, there are too many coincidences prophetically for it to be anything else. Now, I want to move just for a couple of minutes into Genesis 15 and our consecration. Did you know that our consecration is kind of pictured here in Genesis 15? Again, he says, bring me a heifer, a female goat, and a ram. And take a look at the size of these animals. Now, the female goat might not be that big. The ram is pretty decent size. A heifer is massive. And God asks them to cut them in half and lay them against each other. And then it says they did not cut the birds in half. Let me ask you. Now, keep in mind, Abraham had servants to help with this work. But if you had to kill all of these animals in one day, if you had to cut them in half and you had to lay them against each other, how physically exhausted would you be? I think you'd be pretty tired. That is a lot of strenuous work. Now, what happens after that, though, is it said that birds of prey came down upon the carcasses and Abraham had to drive them away. So after the exhaustion of cutting these animals in half, laying them against each other, now there are vultures that are swooping in and trying to eat these animals, which makes sense. That's what vultures do. They're birds of prey. And what does a swarm of vultures look like? Well, imagine that setting. And when you were spending all your afternoon after setting up these animals for a sacrifice and then had to spend your energy driving them away again, how tired would you be? And the answer is you would be extremely tired. And so we come to this next portion here in Genesis 15, 12, and it says, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep on Abram. And of course, who can blame him? Who'd have much energy after that? And it says, behold, a dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. And so what that means is that Abraham was never actually able to complete the sacrifice. But then we have this miraculous occasion in verse 17. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. And in verse 18, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Well, Abram. So what does this mean? What does this story mean? This is what I think it means. I think he's telling us, spend all of your energy in his service. Abraham was not physically able to complete the sacrifice, and neither are we. And Abraham was running around and chasing away these vultures. That's the equivalent of us spending all of our time and energy in serving the Lord and driving away all of these things that are trying to get between us and the Lord and our sacrifice, all of the temptations, all of the flesh, all the elements of the world. You heard Brother Tim talk about some of the things in the world that there are to distract us. God completing the covenant with Abraham while he was asleep, while his energy was spent, is the equivalent of his miraculous work in us when we aren't able physically. We aren't able to be perfect. We aren't able to be completing our own sacrifice. So regardless of the failures in the flesh, that's the equivalent of him completing the sacrifice with Abraham. That's the work he does with us. An example of that is, therefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. And so the portion where he says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, give the Lord your all. That is Abraham running around to set up these sacrifices and chase away the birds. But he completes the sacrifice. He performs the miracle. Keep in mind, it's God who works in us both to will and to work his good pleasure. And so the message is that I'll close with is, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. When the flesh feels weak, stand in a position of confidence, not in yourself, but in a position of confidence with God. And so I find that to be a wonderful lesson for me personally. When you fail, when you don't do the things that you would really like to do, like Paul says in Romans, when you come short of living up to the standard of perfection in God's presence, keep in mind that God is working a miracle in you. And don't lose heart. Don't lose faith. Just keep moving forward.